According to Bloomberg, the White House is urging Congress to approve $145.9 billion for procurement funding that will allow the military to purchase 61 F-35 jet fighters from Lockheed Martin Corp., fewer than previously planned, as well as the B-21 bomber from Northrop Grumman Corp. and two Virginia-class submarines from General Dynamics Corp. and Huntington Ingalls Industries Corp. The president's latest budget proposal will land on Capitol Hill amid the operation in Ukraine, which has thus far proven to be a major boon for the U.S. weapons industry as the Biden administration pours arms into the country. The hawks in Washington want to jack up the military budget and use Ukraine as an excuse. William Harting, a senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, argued in a recent interview on Democracy Now!, noting that Biden's new military budget request amounts to $100 billion more than was spent at the height of the Cold War, adjusted for inflation. Such a massive military budget increase, Harting warned, is only going to benefit weapons contractors and members of Congress who receive campaign contributions from them. In a statement recently, Harting said that his spending to address the crisis can be more than readily accommodated under current Pentagon spending levels. The Pentagon budget is replete with examples of waste and dysfunction that must be addressed before going on a new spending spree, he added. This includes dangerous or unworkable systems like F-35 combat aircraft and the new intercontinental ballistic missile ICBM. Add to this the routine contractor practice of grossly overcharging of the Pentagon for spare parts and the steep cost of runs on major systems, and there is room to cut tens of billions of dollars from the Pentagon budget without diminishing the security. In his budget request for the current fiscal year, Biden asked for $753 billion in military spending, and Congress ultimately approved $782 billion, an indication that lawmakers could add to the president's new $813 billion proposal. Last week, Representatives Barbara Lee and Mark Pocan, the co-chairs and founders of the Defense Spending Reduction Caucus, warned Biden that dumping more money into the Pentagon's overflowing coffers will continue to starve our domestic priorities of needed funding. In recent days, the Biden administration has had to begin shutting down key coronavirus pandemic response programs due to GOP obstruction of new funds. Meanwhile, Republican lawmakers and some hawkish Democrats have clamored for more Pentagon funding. Some of our colleagues will continue to seek virtually unlimited amounts of funding for the Department of Defense, no matter the department's own assessments of its needs for the coming fiscal year. This mission creep is dangerous to peacekeeping efforts, Lee and Pocan wrote in a letter to Biden, adding, diplomacy and international aid will suffer, as will our response to the larger threats currently facing the nation, the ongoing global pandemic and climate change. Yifat Saskind, executive director of the Global Women's Rights Organization, MADRE, argued recently that endless military spending isn't giving us security. It's robbing our communities of the resources they need to be secure, like healthcare and green energy, adding, we are being robbed of resources to feed the endless hunger of the military-industrial complex. Midstream.
At the start of the aggression on Yemen in March 2015, the Saudis thought that their decisive storm would pass heavy on Ansarullah, especially after the movement inherited an army exhausted by the defeat of Ali Abdullah Saleh and subsequently Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi in front of the Saudi royal will. Swiftly, though, the leadership of Ansarullah proved that Al Saud's unthinkable had been achieved. On the basis of turning the threat into an opportunity, Yemenis now proudly talk about their transformation into a force that manufactures its needs of weapons suitable for the confrontation strategy set by their leadership to manage the battle with Saudi Arabia and the UAE. After 8 years of the coalition of aggression's war on Yemen, the Yemeni armed forces was able to develop its military capabilities and its war plans and strategies. This allowed the Yemeni resistance to move with great flexibility between defensive forms, for example, in the Battle of the West Coast in 2019, and the strategy of defensive fortifications pursued by the movement inside the city of Hodeidah, and offensive forms like the ground raids that the Yemeni armed forces were launching on Saudi army positions in the cities of Najran, Asir, and Jizan. And sometimes even combining both strategies that was not limited to one type of military operation, but included, first, ground operations that targeted the forces loyal to Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi and other factions inside Yemen. Second, air operations that targeted military and economic facilities inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE using ballistic missiles and recently bomber drones. And third, naval operations by targeting coalition ships with locally developed and manufactured surface-to-sea missiles and unmanned boats. It is true that the 8 years' war posed a great challenge to Ansarullah, but it also immensely surprised the forces of aggression. What Sana'a experienced was the accumulation of capabilities and expertise following the pressure of the siege, the unending bombardment campaign, and the complete lack of foodstuffs, all of which contributed to crystallizing a productive movement in various sectors, specifically the military production sector. Meanwhile, a quick look at the list of Saudi Arabia's goals from the war on Yemen, one easily sees that none of these goals has been achieved until today. On the contrary, Ansarullah excelled beyond all expectations. Among the Yemeni chains of balanced deterrence that penetrated into the Saudi depth was pounding sensitive Aramco oil facilities and desalination plants in Riyadh and Jeddah, the Yemen cyclone that struck the Emirati depth in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, and the breaking the siege operation that targeted Saudi Arabia's economic interests. All of this enabled Ansarullah to shift the military equation to their benefit by air and land and impose a new balancing strategy of deterrence for a war that had begun unequally. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. A large development workshop in which Ansarullah was involved with all its formations and units, which enabled it 8 years into the start of the aggression to develop its military capabilities and develop its war plans and strategies, which qualified it to deal with emergency and accelerated changes in the conditions of the fronts and the field, and to move with great flexibility between defensive systems, offensive ones, and even with a combination between both, and a strategy not limited to one type of military operation. All of this reflected a development that made the popular movement as close as possible to a regular army in its administrative and equipment aspect, while maintaining the flow of movement between patterns and changing strategies with great flexibility, which is one of the most prominent characteristics of popular resistance movements that rely on guerrilla warfare. To discuss this with us from Sana'a is Mr. Ibrahim Shami, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Ibrahim. Now, the Yemeni armed forces excelled on many fronts, on one of which is the ground operations that targeted mercenaries inside Yemen on the border with Saudi Arabia in Najran, Asir, and Jizan, and with air operations as well that targeted military and economic facilities inside Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, and using ballistic missiles and bomber drones, and also with naval operations on three levels here, using with the naval one using surface-to-sea missiles. How do you assess these developing defensive turned into offensive strategies going into the eighth year of the war?
First of all, thank you very much for having me today. To answer this question, Dr. Marwa, let's review together how this war started. Actually, the operation started in 22nd of March 2015. And shortly after that, they announced that all targets accomplished by the Saudi-led coalition. Actually, that was by 20th of April 2015. And they started the second operation, which they call it the Restoring Hope. I don't know which hope they are talking about. But they started this operation when Asiri announced that all targeted has been achieved. What targeted they were talking about? They were talking about destroying all military camps, weapons stores, and the next targets for them was to keep the civilians safe. This is what they announced. And after that, actually, 7 years later, they keep targeting the same targets. There is nothing new for them. That's all in their target banks. On the other hand, our military armed forces, they started, we can say, from actually zero, because they started with traditional weapons, with Kalashnikov, with missiles, that missiles with the distance you are talking about, 40 kilometers, at that time. So what they need to do, they need to keep the defense strategy to give us the time, the needed time for the continuous improvement. This is what they worked on, because they have the will, they have the determination, they have the cause. So they work on that for these several years. What's going now these days, the muscles they have, which reach the enemy depths in Jizan, Jeddah, Riyadh, also Dubai, Abu Dhabi, it takes them many years. But what they actually did, they transferred the defense strategy to offensive strategy. So they keep defending the objectives of the enemy to keep the continuous improvement with the times. Now we have muscles, we have Quds the second, we have Burkan the second, we have too many muscles, we have the bomber drones, which we have the boats that we are using in our latest operations. Mm-hmm. We will keep targeting our enemies until we achieve the whole target.
It's very important what you are mentioning, Mr. Ibrahim, especially that we saw many changes that the Yemeni resistance went through with the deterrence balance that penetrated into the Saudi depth and hit targets in Riyadh, in Jeddah, in Abha, Jizan, Najran. We had the Yemen cyclone that you mentioned that hit Abu Dhabi and Dubai. We also had the breaking the siege operation, which also targeted Saudi Arabian economic facilities, especially like Aramco and the desalination points and institutions. How is Yemen capable of establishing a deterrence equation based on balance of force when their opponents have state-of-the-art weaponry and defensive systems like this?
The focal points in your question is the cause. What's the cause behind this war? What's the cause that the Saudi-led coalition started this war? They don't have a cause. They bring miseries from different countries, from different nationalities, to fight on behalf of the Saudi soldiers. They don't have the cause. On the other hand, our forces, they have the cause. They have to resist this. They are they are now stronger than ever because they have a cause. They have to define on the integrity of the Yemeni people. They have to define on the our independence of decision. So we have the cause. When the people they have a cause, they have this power. While the Saudi forces, they don't have a cause to fight. What they did actually, they just keep destroying our facilities, civil infrastructure. Mm-hmm. They are killing people. So what they achieved really? They don't achieve anything. Just they keep destroying our economy. But for us, as I mentioned before, the offensive strategy is actually a part of the defensive strategy. We are doing this attack to defend ourselves, to defend our independence.
Do you think that these attacks will actually help end the siege, lift the siege, and end the war?
Yes, if we keep if you review all the last 7 years, you will see we have many target banks. While they don't have anything else to do, they just keep targeting the same targets all the time. Mm-hmm. But actually, the last attack, we don't need to wait for General Sariq to tell us what's going on. We directly know from Saudi channels. They told us what's going on. This is for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely what we are seeing this year from the Yemeni armed resistance is something new and something that the enemy is really surprised with, but something that most definitely is hopeful for the Yemeni people. Hopefully that this will be the last year of war and aggression against the Yemeni people. I want to thank you very much from Sana'a, Mr. Ibrahim Ashami, political commentator, for joining us to talk about the deterrence balance of the Yemeni resistance. Please stay tuned because next we will be talking about the Iranian foreign minister's visit to Beirut. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said upon his arrival in Beirut that he consulted continuously with Lebanese officials on bilateral relations and affirmed his country's readiness to build bridges of cooperation with Lebanon in various fields, most notably the economic sector. Now, in a statement upon his arrival in Beirut on Thursday, Amir Abdullahian said that about a month ago, during meeting with Prime Minister Najib Miqati at the Munich Forum, he suggested to him Iran's willingness to contribute to building two power plants in Lebanon with a capacity of 1,000 megawatts for each station. Now, Abdullahian reiterated his country's affirmation of providing the aid that Lebanon needs in various fields, pointing out that he discussed its details with the officials that he had met, especially with Prime Minister Najib Miqati, for providing wheat and other necessary foodstuffs for Lebanon. Iranian Foreign Minister in Beirut in this morning report.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived last week in Beirut from the Syrian capital, Damascus, on an official visit to Lebanon where he stayed for one day, during which he met with the President of the Republic, Michel Aoun, the Speaker of Parliament, Nabih Birri, and the Prime Minister, Najib Miqati, and Minister of Foreign Affairs, Abdullah Bouhabib, in addition to meetings with political and party figures, on top of which was Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian reiterated Iran's intention to help Lebanon, recalling the Iranian offer to build two electric power plants, which would provide 2,000 megawatts to the Lebanese electricity grid. According to the statement of the Lebanese presidency, the Iranian minister also presented the outcome of the talks between his country and Saudi Arabia, the ongoing negotiations in Vienna, and the positions of the countries concerned about them, expressing his optimism that these talks will lead to positive results soon. After his meeting with Foreign Minister Abdullah Bouhabib, Abdullahian said that Iran wanted nothing but prosperity and happiness for Lebanon and the Lebanese, declaring that it had presented Lebanese officials with the aim of helping Lebanon solve its crisis with a basket of positive and constructive proposals. In this context, Abdullahian referred to his assertion to Prime Minister Najib Miqati during their meeting on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference last month that Iran is still ready to move forward to achieve the vital and urban project in Lebanon through the development of two plants to produce electrical energy in the Lebanese territories, each operating with a capacity of 1,000 megawatts. The Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, received Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian and his accompanying delegation in the presence of Iranian Ambassador Mohammad Jalal Fairuznia, where they reviewed the latest situation in the region, current developments, and ways to confront political, security, and economic challenges. Expressions of concern are growing in Beirut as the Lebanese begin to lose their internal safety nets at the moment of the intensification of the financial economic crisis. This makes the renewed Iranian offer an urgent necessity for Lebanon as the country's need for support increases at all levels, which raises the question about the ability of Prime Minister Najib Mikati's government to defy Western vetoes, specifically the American and Persian Gulf vetoes, to which previous governments conceded as some of its components were either subjected to American dictates or to comply with Washington's policies in the region. This was reflected in an absolute rejection of any Iranian offer, regardless of its size or usefulness, while insisting on limiting the acceptance of aid from specific Western-approved states, while keeping Lebanon under the tutelage of the Persian Gulf Arab states. In other words, the Lebanese government and Lebanese officials are today facing a test of courage to decide to accept the Iranian offer without coordinating with the West.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, member of the Lebanese parliament in the loyalty to the resistance bloc Hezbollah. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Ibrahim. Now, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian affirmed Iran's readiness to build bridges of cooperation with Lebanon in various fields, especially in economy and trade. This is not the first time that Iran actually extends its helping hand for Lebanon, yet Lebanese officials seem to be taking their time to accept these offers. How do you assess such an approach?
Well, first, thank you for having me in your program. This is a pleasure always.
My pleasure.
Actually, this is very obsessive. This is very puzzling, for anyone to see that Lebanon, who is suffering all these critical issues, at this very critical juncture of time, we need a lot of things. We have to find any way to get help from anybody. We, for example, at the block, at the our parliamentary block, we have said it. Our Secretary General in the party, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, has said it. We would welcome any help from any country, from any state, providing that this should not be conditioned with any political terms or whatever. Now we're having Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, has offered quite several times that it's ready to help Lebanon in many different various fields, whether building power plants, just like what you have said, whether with contributing to Lebanon in different issues on the industrial issues, in the other necessities like food and other very important materials. On the other hand, we see that the Lebanese authorities is turning a deaf ear and a blind eye to all the offers from Iran. Why they are doing this? We all know why. Because the Americans have the veto power. Because our leaders at the country, I'm sorry to say that, those who are officially responsible for the country, wouldn't take a very courageous, I wouldn't put it as courageous a step, to accept any help from any country, to take, to assume their own responsibilities about the people. If you cannot do it yourself, if you cannot bring from your allies from outside, at least try to find anything as a replacement. Try to give the alternative. The alternative is not there. Everybody knows it's pretty political issues that are meddling their fingers, and the people are paying the price. What we really need seeing, we need seeing the officials in Lebanon taking a step to help their own people, or even if you want to exercise a pressure. If the Americans don't want this help from Iran, okay, let them give us half of the Iranian offer, and we would accept it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Moussaoui, upon meeting with the Lebanese president, Michel Aoun, after the meeting with Foreign Minister Abdullahian, he expressed hope. Our president expressed hope that the rounds of dialogue between Iran and Saudi Arabia will actually resume, given their role in the region and at the international level, so that efforts will reflect positively. This is how our president put it, that it will reflect positively on the region and contribute to strengthening rapprochement between countries. How would Lebanon benefit from a positive Saudi-Iranian relationship here?
Well, what we have, our president alluded to, is very true, actually, because we know very well that there is a political division, a vertical political division in the country. There are people who follow a certain line, which boils down to the interest of the Americans and their allies in the region. And Saudi Arabia is the number one ally to the Americans in the region. And we know there is another camp here, political camp, which is the, we can talk about it, or we can dub it as the resistance sector and the resistance axis in all of the region. And Iran is the stronghold of all those who believe in the resistance against the occupation and oppression and against the world arrogance represented by the American government. So actually, if there was a rapprochement, just like what you said, between Iran and Saudi Arabia, this is going to reflect positively, this is going to ease the situation, and this is going to make the issues that are very hot colder and colder. People would at least come together, I mean, the officials from this side and that side. Let me put a very simple thing here and very clear. From our side, say, for example, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, he's highly respected and appreciated, and they all listen to him and accept what he says in our axis of the resistance, whether in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, even Palestine, and beyond that. He has voluntarily, he has, like at the start, expressed our willingness to accept any help that would contribute to alleviate the crisis on the Lebanese. While on the other side, they wouldn't accept the Iranian help, and at the same time, they wouldn't offer any alternative. You remember, we all remember when Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah talked about the fuel ships that are coming from Iran, and at the same time, we saw that the American representative in Lebanon, American ambassador Dorothy Shea, she came abruptly out of any sequence. She came to say that we will offer Lebanon the help, and we want to bring and transfer electricity from Jordan, and we will allow them to get even the fuel or gas from Egypt. 8 months have passed, and we didn't see anything materialize in these promises. So they wouldn't allow Iran, or they would put veto, or they would blackmail our leaders not to accept the Iranian help. But at the same time, they wouldn't offer half of it. We challenge them. They dare do it now, and we will just say, good for you. We'll clap hands for them, but they won't do it. This will tell you that they are not interested in helping the people.
Definitely.
They are only blindly following the American orders and directions.
Which brings me to the last question briefly, Dr. Moussaoui, about Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's meeting with Iranian Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian, where he explained that Iran had presented Lebanese officials with a basket of positive and constructive proposals with the aim of helping Lebanon. You think that Hezbollah can play a role in getting the rest of the political factions on board Iranian proposals to help Lebanon out of this extravagant economic and financial crisis?
Absolutely, we can help. But let me tell you one simple thing. Things are very clear for everybody. You see, I mean, the Iranian offer is there. It's publicly announced. It's on the air live. It's on official settings as well, with the prime minister, with the president of the republic. So you're talking here about something that all the Lebanese knew about, everyone heard about, and it is presented officially to the officials. They are not taking it. I mean, what Hezbollah can do more than what they... Why the Iranians are doing it? To help the Lebanese, fine. I mean, why don't you make use of it? How can we help Hezbollah? How can it help in bringing more benefits to the Lebanese? Actually, what we really need is a kind of sense of responsibility. If they enjoy the least of responsibility towards their people, they will accept it. If they enjoy the least of independence of decision-making, they will do it. They will accept it. The problem is here. From our side, we have convinced and we have expressed our willingness to talk with our allies to come and help. And they came and helped. They offered officially help. They cannot do it with their allies. And if they can't do it, why they are putting the veto on Iran to offer Lebanon what they offered?
Well, we have to see how things work out in Lebanon, especially when the elections are just at the door.
Hopefully.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, member of the Lebanese Parliament in the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Hezbollah, for joining us to talk about Iran's, again, offer to help out Lebanon. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream. Thank you for being with us. I'll see you next week.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
We cannot rely on the Western media to tell the whole truth about Palestine, says Paul Salvatore, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Justice for Palestine Cannot Depend on Media Coverage. Stay tuned for more. Countless articles are already out there on the necessity of world crises, as well as being critical of the media's double standard of covering atrocities inflicted by different states but not the Zionist regime. You can easily find them online if by chance, stress by chance, haven't seen them. We want to focus on what the lack of Palestinian coverage is doing. It is further undermining confidence that the world cares about Palestine as much as it does about other countries. Perhaps that would be different if the media, actually we are referring to Western media unless otherwise specified, made it okay to support Palestine instead of routinely framing or reducing it to the bane of the Zionist regime. We don't think people realize how terrorized Palestinians themselves are by the Zionist regime, daily being harassed, killed, abused, dispossessed by this regime. We only hear about Palestine, it seems that, when it is under aerial siege, such as last year in May. Even then, however, the media presents a picture of the Zionist regime defending itself against resistance groups or some other enemy of freedom and democracy. In contrast to its stance on Ukraine, the Western media never portrays Palestine as engaged in legitimate resistance against an oppressive force. No, the Palestinian is always a criminal. The Zionist regime, the perpetual victim that can do and does no wrong, as they baselessly claim. Underlying this is the troubling assumption that the Zionist regime has a right to geography and occupies, be it to the detriment of the innocent Palestinian population. Capturing this, Michael Pryor, and the right to the expel, the Bible, and ethnic cleansing rights. What makes the case of Israel-Palestine unique is the claim that the consequential expulsion of the indigenous non-Jewish population belongs within the domain of the rights of those perpetrating the expulsion, rather than being merely the fruit of force. The designation right implies the support of a moral framework bestowing legitimacy, while conquest is conquest, the product of military might, which, in the eyes of the victims, at least last, lacks legitimacy, unquote. Likewise, the media obscures just how often the Zionist regime employs the illegitimate use of force. Instead, they give audiences the false impression that there is occasional flaring of tensions between the Zionist regime and Palestine, as if the former is not proactive in ethnically cleansing the latter, let alone engaged in any form of violence at all. Still others, who object to people making noise about Palestine till Palestine is not going and is not getting as much coverage as Ukraine because the conflict between the Zionist regime and Palestine is old news. The implication, what's happening between the two is normal, a lost cause, that we should turn our attention to what matters now. Those who think this way may be rightfully sympathetic to Ukraine, but there are undoubtedly ignorant too. And that ignorance will be used against them by media to continually divert their attention from Palestine and to any big story, however important, on its merits. We cannot rely on the Western media to tell the whole truth about Palestine. Rather, drawing from the present as a teachable moment, we must strategize ways of amplifying what is happening in Palestine. That can surely and is being done by alternative media, including the one you are listening now. Other ways include demonstrations, petitions, pressuring political representatives to take reports like Amnesty International's recent one on Israeli regime apartheid seriously, and of course continue the efforts through BDS, targeting key political and economic institutions that allow the Zionist regime to commit crimes against humanity with relative impunity. In the process, our morale is boosted, overcoming the loss of confidence described and maintaining a spiritedness required to fight oppression in any form. Apart from indignation, the sadness of seeing Palestine suffer afflicts all in its struggle for justice. Yet, the more we turn outward and act collectively, the closer we move towards achieving that. How the media covers that is secondary. Essential is that we do not lose faith in the struggle or one another.
Eight-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Iran was as if in a golden age of modernization, even if it were a farce or an aspiration in need of time to become real. Then why a revolution and severing ties with a powerful ally, the United States of America? Well, partly to fulfill another aspiration, independence. Now, how realistic could that be for a developing country such as Iran? The past 40-plus years since the 1979 Islamic Revolution will tell. Iran has been under UN and US sanctions since the Islamic Republic taking over from a millennia-old monarchy which had ended in a pseudo-constitutional monarchy. And for the past couple of years, Iran's economy has gone into something of a recession following COVID-19, which followed a US maximum pressure campaign. However, this country's economy has shown signs of growth, which means the maximum pressure campaign has failed. For more reasons why it has failed, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Iran's economy grew 2.4% in 2020-21, according to the World Bank. And it was forecast to grow 3.1% in 2021-22. The economy is hence a lot more resilient than its boycotters predicted, although, to be fair, not all problems stemmed with sanctions. The economy's resilience is basically because it is diversified, and Iran has found allies beyond the US sphere of absolute influence. How sincere they are, time will tell. Our show guest gives us his forecast. Mr. Ghaffari is an international columnist with Jame Jam and Resalat Dailies. He's never short on background or insight with current affairs.
Obviously, we have a yardstick here called our national interest, based on which we decide in what areas and matters we can have overlapping interests with other actors, both strategically and tactically. Certainly, we might have opposing views with Beijing and Moscow on some issues, but provided that the path is laid out based on our national interests, it seems to be a reasonable way to go.
Now, Iran's economy is still standing is not the only reason why America's maximum pressure on us has failed, according to American politicians themselves. Also, the balance of power or influence in West Asia has tipped to the disadvantage of America. Mr. Hanizadeh is an analyst of West Asia affairs. Unable to meet face to face, he still gave us some of his time on Skype.
Of course, Iran has been able to create a better situation economically due to its vast territories and its remarkable clout in the region. There are 14 countries neighboring Iran in the region, a large portion of which have balanced and improved ties with Iran. This has led to an increase in Iran's economic activity with its neighbors to acceptable levels. As an example, the trade volume between Iran and Iraq has topped $10 billion annually. Iran has established economic ties with Afghanistan, Pakistan, Turkey, Azerbaijan Republic, Qatar, and even some of the Persian Gulf states, including Kuwait and the UAE. This is Iran's advantage and what has set Tehran apart from other countries that are under U.S. sanctions.
The maximum pressure campaign against Iran was initiated by former U.S. President Trump when he unilaterally pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal, or JCPOA, to strike a better deal. That, he hoped, would restrict Iran's ballistic missile program and its influence in West Asia, in its own neighborhood and region, that is. But as time goes by, his hopes seem more and more far-fetched by the day. The Trump campaign has been maintained by the Biden administration, although they realize it has been an abject failure. But perhaps they have seen no other choice.
Some of them, including Mr. Antony Blinken, believe that the U.S. must receive concessions from Iran in return for sanctions relief. This meant that they didn't want to grant concessions to Tehran, but wanted to win some concessions too. But Biden did not subscribe to the optimistic view of Antony Blinken from the beginning. Anyway, the U.S. government and Biden's foreign policy team are yet to reach a consensus on how to return to the JCPOA. But the important point is that the Biden administration has realized that Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign not only did not work, but only helped strengthen the Islamic Republic of Iran in the international arena.
U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price said the previous administration left behind a terrible set of options, which in regard to Iran, everything the maximum pressure campaign promised, the opposite ended up coming true. The nuclear deal was intended to limit Iran's peaceful nuclear program, which the West suspects regardless, in return for lifting nuclear-related economic UN sanctions off this country to get its foreign trade up and running. Iran did comply for even a year after Trump binned the deal in May 2018 and imposed the harshest ever U.S. sanctions on this country. But when Iran got nothing of significance from Western parties to the deal, all that happened is it began reversibly inching away from its commitments, and its capability has jumped from enriching uranium to 20% purity to 60% purity, Ned Price lamented. We inherited an Iranian nuclear program that was galloping ahead, that has continued to gallop ahead. Now, no one seems to want to let go of whatever is left of the deal, which was signed between Iran and the P5 plus one, and with a US pullout held between Iran and the P4 plus one. That's the UK, France, Russia, China, and Germany. To salvage what use remains for the nuclear deal, parties have been in nuclear talks for almost a year. Mr. Yazdan Panah is a geopolitics professor whose interest in the country's benefits goes beyond politics. He shared his scientific outlook at Press TV Studios.
It doesn't seem like a revival of the JCPOA would be the end of all sanctions against Iran. We need to wait and see what happens. But removing a considerable amount of sanctions could potentially be a prelude to and lay the groundwork for a departure from the current state of affairs between Iran and the United States. Take Pakistan, for example, during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan after the 9/11 attacks. Pakistan had been under U.S. pressure and harsh economic sanctions. The two sides didn't have any ties at all, the same as Iran. But in a sudden change of policy, they decided to end the hostilities. The two sides established very close ties. The future is unpredictable. Maybe such a change could take place in the ties between Iran and the U.S. Although, as I said, considering the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, such a change is unlikely.
But although U.S. President Biden had vowed to re-enter the agreement, the original nuclear deal that is, and although he dismisses Trump's attempt as a failed maximum pressure, he has both kept all the sanctions imposed under Trump and has unleashed new ones on Iran. Yet Iran stands. How so? Well, this country's economy and partners are diversified with initiatives as to how to find a way around U.S. sanctions and currency. Maximum pressure sanctions had aimed to bring Iran's crude exports down to zero, but well. Iran's oil minister, Javad Oji, boasted, "We have changed contracts and diversified them to attract and encourage investors. In the next 8 years, we will allocate $15 to $20 billion in oil and gas resources to develop the fields, and about the same amount will be invested by Chinese investors in a 25-year agreement with banks and holdings contributing to the field's profits. We will try to have similar contracts with the Russians, like the Chinese." China has kept Iran's oil sales flowing in defiance of U.S. sanctions, even if at a lower price. Now, Russia is a very different case. Iran and Russia both being global energy giants, Russia must see our resources as competition, especially now that with the Ukraine conflict, it has been boycotted by its fellow Europeans to whom it was the energy provider.
خب یکی از موضوعاتی که بالاخره اینجا ما حکم رقیب رو داریم.
One of the issues in which we are considered rivals is the oil and energy sector. This is something over which mistakes are made. I mean that long-term strategic commonalities are taken as absolute agreements in all respects. This is surely a mistake. We have shared goals on some issues and we have differing views on others. These distinctions must be observed in our calculations, behavior, and even our officials' rhetoric.
Yet, Orji insists that with Russia, we have a comprehensive roadmap in the field of oil and gas industry in all upstream and downstream sectors. Now, another neutralizer of America's evil attempts against Iran is this country's acceptance of technology as a hub of science in ancient and olden pre- and post-Islamic eras. Also, the neutralizer simply of U.S. hegemony and or its influence in West Asia is majorly Iran's asymmetric tactics of forging regional alliances. For a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Plenty more needed to fill in the gaps, but first it's back indoors for a quick media review to give other outlets a chance to have their say. Here's how it's been put down in writing. The print runs the headline, "The sanctions work. Lessons from Russia, Iran and the US war on terror." Economic sanctions can only be one tool in the Western toolbox for enforcing their designed global peace. While they have imposed great economic pain in the past, they have been more unsuccessful than successful in achieving their political goal. The key determinant of sanctions' success is how the sanctions target versus the cost of changing its behavior compared to the economic cost imposed. That is disconnection from international financial markets. Targeted sanctions became much more central to the U.S.'s sanctions policy after the crippling sanctions on Iraq during the 1990s, which primarily had the effect that the Iraqi people suffered but did not succeed in fundamentally changing the calculations of the Iraqi regime. Donald Trump's unilateral policies of maximum pressure failed in changing Iran's or Venezuela's policies, even though they brought back comprehensive sanctions. We've got a word from Mehr News. Cleric warns U.S. to wait for more humiliating defeat from Iran. Referring to a U.S. failure of an exertion of a maximum pressure campaign against Iran, Tehran Provincial Friday Prayers leader said, "We tell them officials to wait for another disgraceful defeat from Iran in the current year." Addressing worshippers at Tehran's Imam Khomeini Musalla, Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Khatami reiterated that U.S. officials themselves have acknowledged that the maximum pressure campaign policy against Iran has completely failed. Turning to the slogan of the current year named by the leader of the Islamic Revolution as the year of production, knowledge-based job creating, Tehran Interim Friday Prayers leader recommended government officials to make their utmost efforts in line with realizing the objectives of this slogan in the current year of 1401, which started on March 20th, 2022. That'll be it. Thanks for staying with us, but there's more of the show coming up. Iran, as an embracer of new generational technology, became the second country in West Asia to connect to the internet. That was in 1993. Other examples are: this country successfully launched its first satellite into orbit in 2009. Also, Iran has done big on nanotechnology. It even put its first drone into operation in 1985.
During the Saadabad talks with the European sides, Mr. Jack Straw, Joschka Fischer and Dominique de Villepin, the British, German and French foreign ministers, Iran once made a request to acquire some centrifuges for research and scientific purposes, so the students and those who want to work in the field of nuclear energy could use them as educational tools. But they did not allow that even at such a level. But today, thanks to the efforts put in by scientists, some of whom were martyred, we have been able to manufacture thousands of centrifuges and use them for educational purposes and R&D.
It was on the scale of a country with a medium-sized economy that the Islamic Revolution took place. But it has proven over time that it can impact relations and plans drawn up for the region.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been confronting the U.S. and some of its allies, including Israel, over the past four decades. It has adopted different ways to confront the U.S. anti-Iran efforts, including relying on the inside, boosting the resistance economy, and creating alliances with its neighbors, including Iraq, Qatar, Azerbaijan, and Afghanistan. These countries have established balanced ties with Iran in the past four decades, especially after the overthrow of Saddam's regime in 2003. Iraq is considered to be aligned with Iran. Also, Qatar and some of the Arab states south of the Persian Gulf have created balanced political ties with Iran.
Iran's regional rivals have spent billions of dollars on Western weaponry, a lot of it coming from the UK. But as the BBC observed in 2019, sanctions-bound Iran has succeeded in embedding itself across the region into a position of strategic advantage for just a fraction of that cost. How is that it built up a network of non-state alliances right across West Asia, basically to keep danger far from its borders, in aiding countries against Western interference or in response to a cry for help from fellow Shia populations across the region. Although, as a natural consequence of its presence as a regional state most capable of securing the region, Iran may continue to seize opportunities to expand its third-party capability. Talking of third parties, Hezbollah, for one, has acted as central interlocutor for an array of Arab political parties with ties to Iran.
According to the U.S. calculations, it's expected to dominate the entire Syria and Iraq through Daesh. But we saw that did not happen. The reason was that the network of resistance, which comprises Hamas, Hezbollah, Ansarullah, Hashd al-Shaabi, and other groups, was shaped so the groups were able to work towards the same goal. Today, after 43 years, we no longer witness scattered resistance groups in the region, but we're seeing an archipelago of groups who are being considered unified in their principles and goals.
How IISS, the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies, puts it is, the Islamic Republic of Iran has tipped the balance of effective force in the Middle East in its favor by countering superior conventional forces with influence operations and use of third-party forces. The policy of ignoring Iran did not work. Iran resisted. Iran has also successfully controlled damages of U.S. economic terrorism. So yes, it is a powerful nation and has a lot of relations with other nations with a lot of initiatives for regional cooperation. The U.S. may have been in suspense, but with an assuredness it would now reprogram ties and come to a new understanding and deals with leaders of the revolution. But things didn't go to plan, and the U.S. reacted angrily, fighting tooth and nail from the beginning to maintain its position. Sanctions aside, it played a material part in the Iraq attack on Iran in the 1980s.
The United States has hatched numerous plots and schemes against the Islamic Republic of Iran since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, mobilizing terrorist groups inside Iran, provoking different ethnic groups, attempts for staging a coup in Iran, and then the war between Iraq under the former Ba'ath regime of Saddam and Iran to undermine the foundations of the Islamic Revolution. Over the past four decades, the U.S. has also resorted to other tools, namely imposing sanctions, creating an unbearable environment in the region, and fomenting disputes between Iran and its neighbors south of the Persian Gulf and south of the Caucasus. These were among some of the steps Washington took.